Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I started a gourmet in the test kitchen, and I did that for 4 years, and I loved it, but I missed the restaurant business. So when the job in the executive dining room opened up, they let me have it. We had only maximum 16 seats and no food cost. It was a dream job. I got to make these amazing meals. My job was to make the magazine come alive.
This week, we welcome chef, cookbook author, TV personality. You have so many things I could describe you as, Sarah Moulton. Sarah has been described in the New York Times as a dean of food television and magazines. She currently hosts Sarah's Weeknight Meals on PBS, co-hosts Milk Street Radio with Chris Kimball, and somehow finds the time to write regular food columns for both the Associated Press and the Washington Post. And oh yeah, she's the mother of two terrific kids. I guess they're not kids anymore, are they?
No, they're young adults.
And the wife of hip-hop chronicler Bill Adler, who's so cool, he donated the Adler Hip-Hop Archives to Cornell University. Welcome to Special Sauce, Sarah.
Thanks, Ed.
Oh, man, where do we start? I guess we should start where we always start on Special Sauce, at the beginning. So tell us about life at the Moulton family table growing up.
Oh, my mom was an amazing cook.
Really?
And as you know, your wife's mom was a good friend of my mom.
Yes.
Isn't it funny how circuitous the whole thing is? And you and Bill knew each other through the music industry.
Yeah.
But anyway, my mom was an amazing cook, and it was something that was always important to her. So she moved to New York when she first got married and worked at Mademoiselle magazine. And she and Daddy lived, you know, in this wonderful apartment with my uncle, and she loved to throw dinner parties. And what she used as her source was the New York Times cookbook, which, is I found out, was a very important cookbook for a lot of chefs back then and moving forward. But at any rate, so she would throw these dinner parties, and then she started traveling to Europe. And like anybody else, when you come back, you want to make the food. If you love food, which she did,
right. You
want to make the food of the place you've just been. So, you know, back in the 60s, she was making moussaka and paella and all of these things. So
wow,
these,
man.
Those were the dinner parties. But nightly dinner was pretty damn good, too. I mean, talk about in the 60s, I was exposed to fresh fennel and endive, and she was cooking with mushrooms and anchovies. And
she was Alice Waters before Alice Waters.
Right, our own little private home. And she was religious about family dinner. And also, not only that we eat it, that we sit down, that she make it from scratch, for the most part. We did have frozen vegetables, you know, every so often. And occasionally she would ignore us and we'd have to have a TV dinner when they had date night. But she also was insistent on good quality conversation. So that was a part of it. We all had to sit there and dine. We didn't just scarf it down and watch TV.
Wow. Did the conversation go beyond what was the best thing that happened in your day kind of thing?
Occasionally, yes. And towards the end, absolutely. I mean, when Annie and I were in high school, and my sister, my older sister and I, my brother was sort of, we refer to him as the oops baby. He doesn't like that. He's 9 years younger than her and 7 years younger than me.
I was the oops baby. I was 11 years younger than my oldest brother.
Wow.
I was the oops. I was supposed to be a girl.
Oh, geez.
Because I have three older brothers.
Oh.
One just died, so I have two older brothers. But, my mother kept going because her brother had kept going and had a girl on the fourth.
Damn, your poor mom. And then she got you.
And then she ended up with
me. Wow.
That's losing on so many fronts.
Yeah.
So did you automatically take to watching her in the kitchen?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I became her sous chef in high school just because I wanted to. And we would throw these amazing dinner parties. And then on Sunday morning, Sunday was the only day my mom was on strike and said, I'm not cooking for anybody at any time for any reason. And so we all back then went to church, and we'd come home from church, and we were all left up to our own devices. So my dad would make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. My brother would go to the corner deli and get a, you know, roast beef sandwich.
And this is in Manhattan, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. We lived, downtown. My sister would get yogurt, and my mom would have an exquisite brie with a ripe, perfectly ripe pear. And I would take last night's leftovers and do something different with them.
Like make fried rice out of
yes,
it or whatever?
Exactly. I would get wild with them, and everybody would look at me and have lunch envy. Well, probably not my mom, because she was happy with her perfect pear and,
right.
and ripe brie. But I think that sort of ingrained in my mom that maybe I had some talent. And I would say to this day, I'd rather open up a refrigerator filled with leftovers than start with a blank canvas. I love leftovers. They talk to me.
That's awesome. Yeah. Leftovers talk to me, too. I do the same thing with fried rice. And you don't even have to be a great cook
no,
to do that.
No, Bill does it now, too, my husband. He throws things together and has fun.
So you went off to the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And you got your BA in the history of ideas, is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah,
wow, that's very, very sophisticated.
No, actually, it was just a cop-out. It was a hippie major. It was, I was in a small part of the U of M where we had no grades, just evaluations. So it was sort of this creative little hotbed called the Residential College, part of the Literature, Science, and Arts. And that was just one of the, you know, loosey-goosey majors I could have, so I did it.
Yeah, I know all about Lucy. I was an American music major, and I did my senior thesis on Charlie Parker, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington.
Wow, nice. Which, I'd love to see that.
Well, it's actually consisted of three all-night radio shows of me reading liner notes and playing music.
Oh, okay. So,
and
yeah,
probably
you do
smoking
know.
Some substance that may or may not be legal in the
yeah,
state of
got
Iowa.
Got it. Okay.
So you go to Michigan. And did your love of food manifest itself there in any way?
Well, the funny thing was I always had a job because you got to make extra money when you're in college, and it was always in some food establishment. So either as a waitress, including I was a waitress at an all-night diner where we had to wear a Day-Glow orange uniform and white nurse's shoes.
Wait a minute. Whoa.
Yeah.
A Day-Glow orange
yeah,
uniform.
Yeah, it was like polyester, worse. It was like plastic. I don't know, but we had to wear this uniform and white nurse's shoes. And I had the graveyard shift on Friday and Saturday nights. But aside from that, I ended up cooking for a couple, two professors, you know, a couple of nights a week and their family. And I also then, my last job, I started as a waitress at this bar called the Del Rio, which was this wonderful jazz bar in Ann Arbor. And I ended up in the kitchen. And I loved it. It wasn't fancy food. You know, we make these.
It was
bar
food.
It was bar food, but it was also fun. The one thing I liked the most was we made soups. We had a different soup every day. And I'll be honest with you, we did not use homemade chicken or beef broth. We would use that horrible, god-awful base, you know,
yes.
and then you'd add water to match. But the rest of it was totally, you know, fresh, you know, onions and garlic and whatever. And I had so much fun with that. So that was the last job I had in school. So I'm doing that and living with Bill and making probably $65 a week. I guess the parents must have supplemented the rent. Either that or you could live on $65
right.
a week. I don't really remember. But my mom was horrified. So she wrote to Craig Claiborne and Julia Child, did not ask me, and asked them what her daughter should do if she wanted to become a chef.
Wow, that's
yeah.
so crazy. First of all, let's think about this. There weren't that many moms encouraging their daughters, their middle-class daughters, to become chefs.
No, we were all doctors, lawyers, you know, those kind of people.
Yeah.
And we're talking about 1974 when she wrote this letter.
So did she write it cold, or did she know people who knew people?
She wrote it cold.
She wrote cold?
Yes. But my mother was a good writer, though. Remember, she
right,
was a writer.
Mademoiselle,
right. So, I mean, by then she didn't, but she was a writer. That's what she did. So she didn't hear back from Julia, which is curious, because later on I got to work with Julia, and Julia answered every letter. But Craig did write back, and he said, Craig Claiborne, for those people who don't know, was the author of the New York Times cookbook. So he wrote her back and said, if your daughter wants to go become a chef, she should go to cooking school. Which is interesting because that advice has come back. I give that to young women now sometimes, that advice, because it's hard for a woman to just, it's getting less hard, but it's still somewhat hard for a woman to just walk in a kitchen.
To knock on the door
and
say,
let me wash dishes and I'll work my way up. It just wasn't possible back then.
Wow.
So he said either she should go to the hotel school in Lausanne, which is where he went, or she should go to the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America.
Which wasn't that old at the
no,
that time.
No, I found out actually it started right after World War II in
Got
New
it.
Haven, but it had just moved to Poughkeepsie in the early 70s. But at any rate, I thought, well, I don't want to go to, you know, Swiss Island. That's too far away. I was happy with my little life Ann Arbor, but, you know, I'll apply to the CIA. I'm sure they will not accept me because I don't even know how to use a chef's knife. I'd always thought this might be a fun thing, a bit of a lark. It wasn't completely a cold idea. I'd researched it before, but I hadn't pursued it until my mom did. So the CIA accepted me, and I was like, oh, shit. You know, they've called my bluff here. So I went to Bill, and I said, you don't want me to leave you, do you? I mean, no. And he said, actually, I do. I'd like to see other women. So that shot me out of there like a cannon. and I got to the CIA, and I started in 75, graduated in 77. And I have to say, and it always irritates the husband when I say this, it was the happiest 2 years of my life. Because I found myself, you know, I'm very proud of my children. I'm very proud of many of my things I've done in the industry. But it was so exciting. You know, not that many people find their passion.
Absolutely.
And can pursue it. I felt very blessed.
I feel very blessed in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's that old cliche about if you find something you love, you'll never work a day in your life.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you went, you left Bill.
Yes.
Who showed whom the door there. But anyway, one way or another, you ended up at the CIA. And were there many women?
No, it was 6-1 men to women. And, you know, and also at that time, you know, the demographics have changed. Over the years, there's a lot of career changers now. But back then, it was solidly, most of the men were working class, blue collar, who had families, who had restaurants, and just wanted to get more training. And then there were the women. Most of us were, well, we were a motley crew, but, you know, I'd already gone to college. So these were 18-year-old guys, and I was 23.
Testosterone-driven
18-year-old guys.
Yeah,
and what do they
guys.
Have on their mind? They're not really focusing on training. So you know what they have on their mind. And but they all, most of them, were very disdainful of us women, because what the hell were we doing there? You know, this is not a profession for women. You know the classic, you can't stand the heat, you can't lift the pots, you can't
right.
stand the pressure.
Anne Rosenzweig always talks about, I forgot the French chef that asked her to lift the stock pot, which was like 50 pounds, even though nobody else was asked to lift that stock
right.
pot. And you know Anne Rosenzweig.
She's my size. Maybe
right,
even smaller.
Yeah, she's a seminal woman chef in New York.
Yes.
Still around and doing well. And she said the stuff that she encountered was just incredible.
Definitely. That's what was going on. But for me, actually, that was catnip. It's like, you tell me I can't do it. Well, I am going to show you.
Fuck
and what you. What I had, yes, exactly. You said it. And what I had that they didn't was my Brearley education.
We should say that Sarah went to the same high school that my wife went to, much more rigorous than probably most colleges.
Oh, my God. I had no adolescence because all I did was study. But at any rate, I learned how to study. And even though I sort of didn't bother with it at the University of Michigan, I more grew up there than anything else. By the time I got to cooking school, that kicked back in. And so I became a really good student. And even though the teachers were pretty much like the students, male students, in that we did not, us women did not belong there, they couldn't help but be impressed by us because we took it seriously. We did the homework. We came in prepared. And that really helped me to get through and to do well.
But women always do the homework. Like when I was in business school, I would always have to ask the women that had become my friends because they were so much better prepared. And is it a sense of duty or responsibility that you think women, young women have that young men don't?
I don't know. Ed, that is a really good question. I'm going to have to ponder that one. I wouldn't be surprised if part of it is responsibility. You know, it's not just a lust for knowledge and doing the, you know, but it's also doing the right thing, being a good girl.
Right.
So maybe you're right.
So did you have role models?
When I was in school?
Yeah, when you were at the CIA.
Certainly, some of the other students inspired me, including some of the men. I had this one friend, Mike Garfunkel, who, you know, had cooked Escoffier all the way through and could recite all that stuff. And I had other friends who, you know, helped me out and taught me a lot. So fellow students, certainly some of the professors, I love Chef Zach. Some people found him very intimidating, but I found him very impressive. But in the outside world, not yet.
Wow.
Julia did become a role model and an inspiration, but not at that moment.
Yeah.
I was just trying to make my way through it. I wanted to be the best chef I possibly could.
And it wasn't gender driven. It was just like you were very focused.
Yes, absolutely.
And so then you graduated and you started cooking in Boston, and that's where you met Julia Child.
Yes.
Right? How did that come about?
Well, I moved back to Boston because that's where Bill moved when I left, and we eventually got back together again. I did my externship at The Harvest, a restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Which was a seminal new American restaurant
and
in Cambridge.
So many chefs worked there. Lydia Shire, Chris Schlesinger, Bob McCabe.
I used to say that the Boston chef scene grew out of the Parker House Hotel.
Yes.
But it may have been just as much out of that restaurant,
The Harvest. Yeah, because Lydia worked at both the Parker House and The Harvest, too. So I did my externship there, and then when I was done with school, they hired me back. But management kept changing there. I was sous chef, which was, I was always in over my head, but I'm, you know, it's something you do. You just do what you have to. And so, but they kept changing chefs. And so I ended up at this catering company as the chef manager of a catering company, which I didn't really enjoy. I don't like catering. I don't like cooking for the masses. I'd rather do small restaurant
right.
work. Any rate, one day I was peeling a million hard-boiled eggs with one of my workers to stuff for some event. I don't know. And we started talking about Julia Child, and she said that she actually was a volunteer on Julia's show. Julia, of course, lived in Cambridge.
Right.
And I was like, wow, really? She said, do you think she'd ever want another volunteer? I'd love to work on her show, too. And she said, well, we're just about to tape another season. Let me ask her. So she came in the next day, and she said, I asked Julia if she needed anybody else and told her all about you, and she wants to hire you.
Hire you, not
hire
volunteer.
You. Yeah, I said, excuse me? She wants to pay me? She hasn't even met me. Why? The backstory, I'll get to the punchline, is because I went to the CIA, she thought that I was just going to be everything she ever wanted.
Right.
What she specifically wanted. So I went down to the corner payphone to call her, and she gets right on the phone. She was listed.
What a quaint notion,
payphone. I know. And I did go to the corner payphone because I didn't know where this was going to go, and I didn't want to make the call from work. And she gets right on the phone. She was listed, so people could call her at Thanksgiving.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah. She was famously listed.
Yeah, famously listed. So she gets right on the phone, and she says, oh, hello, dearie. I've heard all about you. Do you food style? Now, back in, this is 1978, nobody, you know, it wasn't the codified art that it is now. I thought to myself, you know, I landed the food nicely on the plate when I was at The Harvest. We just did cold poached decorated salmon for $700. That looked pretty good. You know, I did watercolors in high school. I was really grasping for straws at this point. I think I'm just going to lie. And I said, yes, I'm very good. So she hired me. So,
that's awesome.
So, you know, sometimes I say this to young people who are like scared of their shadows and don't want to try something new or, you know, put themselves out there. And I'm like, sometimes you have to, I'm not encouraging lying, but sometimes you take a little bit of a leap.
Yes. So it's creative license.
Creative license. Well, we have to be careful in these times about lying because it happens an awful lot.
It's true, especially at the top.
Yes, this is true.
Give us a concise answer to what you learned from Julia.
Oh, there's no concise answer. what happens, I worked on the show, it's called Julia Child and More Company, and the cookbook that went with it. And that was a project that took 3 months. Oddly enough, unlike now when you do a public television show, you just bang it out in 5 days or 7 days or 10 days or in those kind of chunks. But back then we spread it out over 3 months. So 3 days a week we would work on it. I could only work two of the three because I ended up becoming chef of a restaurant. So the other five I worked at that place. So I worked 7 days a week for 3 months. It was worth it. But then that relationship continued for the rest of my life, Julia.
Wow.
So, you know, I worked there with her and then later on at Good Morning America. And we always stayed in touch. And she gave me so many introductions to so many things. But over the course of my whole relationship with her, here's what I learned. You never stop learning. You must always strive for excellence. It's a good idea to have more than one job. You know, I want to kill her for that one. At times I had four. You know, and sort of be humble, you know, be nice to everybody. She was very curious.
She was. I remember I only met her once or twice, and she was shockingly unpretentious and
down
lovely.
Down to earth. And wanted to know all about you.
Yes, and was always able to laugh at herself. What a fantastic quality.
She was one of the funniest people I ever met, and I think it's because she was so refreshingly honest. But one last thing she taught me, which was very helpful at the Food Network, which was how to smile and how important it is to smile. And I taught that to Rachel Ray. Rachel Ray will say that. And I used to say it to all of my guests when they come on, because I had something like 500 guests when I was on the Food Network. And I'd always say to them, you know, the last thing before we'd go on air, and smile constantly for no particular reason.
That's awesome.
Because it really helps to get your message across.
So did you and Julia ever talk about gender issues?
Oh, gosh, it's so interesting you should bring that up, because yes and no. One thing is, whenever we'd walk in a restaurant, and besides all of her immediate reactions to the restaurant, you know, what it looked like, what it smelled like, she was famous for walking into a restaurant saying, oh, no, I'm smelling bad fat, because she hated it when people reused the fryolator over and over and over and over again. But the other thing she would often do when because she'd always end up in the kitchen, she'd always get invited, she'd look around for the women. And she'd point out, where are the women? So she did make it an issue. But she got me an apprenticeship after I started working for her to go work at a restaurant in France. And it turned out the chef owner, who was 72, short, fat, bald, and ugly, which is relevant because if he wasn't, it might not have been such an issue, was a dirty old man. And not only would not let me work the line, I was there for 2.5 months, but also, you know, sort of chased me around the wine cellar and really put the moves on me.
Right, and you told that story in the
Huffington Post. So what happened, and I managed to survive because I was smart.
Yes, you spent the night in a hotel room in Paris in twin beds.
Right. Thank you. You read that article.
And it might as well have been the Grand Canyon. Because there was no way he was getting within 5 feet of you.
No way.
And I loved it that you said that you actually put your raincoat on.
With my belt. With the belt around it. Yes,
that's
I did.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, well, send a message there. But anyway, I survived. So it took me 6 months to tell Julia that this guy was, and there's nobody I could talk to because I was working with his wife and his daughters, and you know, I just felt like I couldn't say your husband, your father is, you know, whatever. Anyway, it took me 6 months to tell Julia. I thought she'd be devastated. I mean, when I first got back, I said, "Oh, I learned so much," and I did, by the way. I'm really glad I did it.
But
when I finally told her 6 months later, she said, "Oh, dearie, what'd you expect? They're all like that. Get over it."
Wow.
And at the time, I was like, okay, okay, she's right. They're all like that. Get over it. And then years later, I thought, okay, that's Julia, because she always kept her eye on the prize, and she wouldn't let a silly thing like feminism get in her way. And I'm not throwing any shade on Julia. She is fantastic. However, had I been raped, it would have been a different story.
Right.
And really, it's not acceptable.
Yeah.
None of it is acceptable.
Yeah.
I don't think, by the way, that's the worst issue for women in restaurants is the sexual harassment. I mean, it's very bad. I think there's a bigger issue, which we can talk about. But aside from what I just told you, she didn't really bring up gender issues. She never called herself a chef. She said she was a home cook. But as I've come to learn, you know, sort of specializing in home cooks for many years, starting at Gourmet and then in the Food Network, home cooks can be every bit as proficient and excellent and amazing as restaurant chefs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's genuinely apples and oranges.
Yes, exactly.
In 1982, which is 36 years ago, you founded something called the Women's Culinary Alliance. Was that part a response to your experience in France?
Well, you know, actually, getting back to Julia, this is something I'd forgotten when you just asked me that last question. When we were in Boston, so I was there from 77 to 81, working various jobs, including with Julia. A bunch of women would always work with Julia. You know, she'd do fundraisers for Planned Parenthood or something else, and we'd all go help her. And we'd throw these dinner parties at her house. And we all were talking and, you know, about the industry, and we noticed that men seemed to have male organizations, male chefs. And they seemed to, you know, the boys' club, they support each other.
Right.
So we thought, why don't we form something for us? So we did, in Boston, called the Boston Women's Culinary Guild. And we founded that in, I guess, 1980 or so. And I thought that was a great thing. There was two big flaws with it. One is anybody could join who liked to cook. So we got people who throw a dinner party once every 6 months, and we didn't require people to be active. So it was a great group, but it was flawed. So I moved to New York, and when I moved to New York in 81, Julie gave me introductions to all the great restaurants.
Wow.
And back then, all the great restaurants were helmed by male European chefs. They would have nothing to do with me. They would not hire me. Usually they didn't tell me that, but, you know, they wouldn't. Maybe I'd get an interview, but I just wouldn't be hired.
Right.
And finally, I got a job working for Sally Dar, who had a wonderful restaurant called La Tulipe.
First serious restaurant I ever went to in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
Wasn't it great?
It was awesome.
It was really great. It was really unique. Sally was not a trained chef, but I probably learned more from her than anybody else.
Wow.
And that includes Julia and Jacques Pepin. I learned a ton from Sally. But at any rate, I got a job there. But I still felt like, wait a second, what is going on here? We have the same problem here in New York, of course, in the United States. It's pretty pervasive as we did in Boston, only it's worse.
And Sally was the first serious woman chef at a restaurant in New York, I believe.
Oh, Leslie
right?
Refson.
Oh, Leslie Refson. That's
yes,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Any rate, so by then I was, you know, I'd made friends with a bunch of people at Gourmet Magazine because the chef de cuisine at La Tulipe, I was not the chef. I was the chef Tournant. Sally
right.
was the executive chef, and Guy Rouge was the chef de cuisine. His wife was Mariah. Mariah, nice Southern girl, worked at Gourmet. So I became friends with Mariah, and because of that, I became friends with a lot of people at Gourmet Magazine, which I'd been getting for years and used as an inspiration when
right.
I was a chef. And so I got a bunch of those women together, and we founded the New York Women's Culinary Alliance.
Got it.
And that it was originally supposed to be a baby Dame d'Escoffier. I won a scholarship from Les Dames d'Escoffier when I graduated from CIA. I was one of their first three scholarship winners the first year they did it. Which
and
was
we should explain that what Les Dames is.
Les Dames d'Escoffier is sort of an offshoot of an organization called Les Amis d'Escoffier, which is, again, a male, I don't think it's a chef's organization, but culinary organization. And Carol Brock, who worked at the Daily News, wanted to form a women's equivalent. So she formed Les Dames d'Escoffier. I don't remember what year, but it was probably early 70s. And so that group already existed. The trouble with that group, from my point of view, was that you had to have been accomplished in order to be able to be considered as a member. And I felt there was a need for young women just starting out to have a group for themselves. But nonetheless, Carol asked me if I'd form a junior Les Dames, would I bring a proposal to the board of Les Dames d'Escoffier? So Mariah and I put together a proposal. We took it to the board meeting in 1981, which was held at my friend Jean Anderson's house at 1 Lexington. And we were shot down by the board. Carol hadn't really shared with them that she had this terrific idea for a junior dom. And Mariah was so angry. She's a nice Southern girl, but we went out to Gramercy Park, and you should have heard the expletives coming out of her mouth at those women. But I was thrilled. I was like, we're free. We
yeah.
can now do what we want to. So we did. So we formed this group. And we improved on the two fatal errors from the Boston group. So you have to be a full-time professional. You don't have to be a chef, but you have to be a caterer. You know, and you have to do it at least a minimum of 35 hours a week, whatever you do. And that doesn't seem like a lot. But for people like caterers who have a seasonal business, it averages out to about 35 hours a week. And you had to be active.
Right.
So because of especially the second thing, we lost a lot of chefs. So we don't have a lot of chefs. But it's still going great guns many
yeah.
years later.
That's great.
And we want young women to join. We'll take you right out of cooking school.
Right.
New York Women's Culinary Alliance.
So you mentioned Gourmet Magazine, and you ended up being the corporate chef there.
Right.
What did that entail, and why did you transition to that?
Okay, very good. You were asking all these great questions, of course. Who doesn't like to talk about themselves? So there you go. But I started at Gourmet in the test kitchen, and I did that for 4 years. And I loved it. We tested, developed, and styled food for photography there. I finally was styling food for photography. But I missed the restaurant business. When the job in the executive dining room opened up, I grabbed it. You know, they gave it, they let me have it. And what that was a corporate dining room where we entertained clients being advertisers. We had only maximum 16 seats and no food cost. It was a dream job. And at first I thought, wow, I've sold my soul to the devil. I'm working with advertisers. That's terrible. But it sort of was fun because, A, our advertisers were very Tony. They were the kind of advertisers you'd want. We didn't have Cheese Whiz or anything. Although Cheese Whiz has a place.
Right.
But, you know, I didn't have to do anything with Cheese Whiz or any, you know, those kind of things. So I got to make these amazing meals. My job was to make the magazine come alive. So I would cook from the most recent issue. But also it sort of became a challenge and fun. An advertiser would come to us and say, well, we don't think you're a food and travel magazine. And then I would cook them a whole meal from one issue around the globe.
Right.
Or they'd say, we don't think your recipes are accessible enough. And I'd have them in for a cooking class and make five recipes that were so accessible. So I loved the challenge and also helping advertisers to figure out how to, you know, improve their image or any number of things. So it was a great job.
Yeah.
Loved it.
And was it also because you realized you, if you were going to have a family, that it was going to be tough to stay in the restaurant
business?
Oh,
that's absolutely why I left the restaurant industry. I always thought I'd go back, but to have kids. So I did. I left La Tulipe to do that. And as I thought at first I'd just do freelance recipe testing development, but then the job at Gourmet opened up first in the test kitchen. And I always thought I'd go back, but then I realized kids don't just need you. I mean, because you work 80 hours a week when you're a chef.
Right.
I think it's very hard for women to do that because you, as a woman, I want to be with the kids. But at any rate, I just thought there's no way I can have kids and do that. But I realized kids don't just need you as newborns, elementary school, high school. Apparently,
they kids need even need us now,
young
Sarah.
Adults, yeah. Yeah, Ed, we're not dead yet as parents.
And then you combine that with GMA, though, right?
Right.
This is where you started juggling.
Right. I blame Julia. So Julia started coming to New York in 81 to tape episodes at GMA, and she'd come and tape four or five. And I missed her, you know, because I wasn't in Boston anymore. We weren't making dinner parties at her house. So I said, let's go out to dinner. And she said, oh, she had too much prep. She didn't think she'd be able to get out. So I said, let me come over and help you for free, and then I'll take you out to dinner. And that happened. And the next day, GMA hired me to start working there.
Wow.
Now, I only did that for a few months because Sally didn't want me to have a second job. But I went back, you know, in 87 and started doing it again. And then I did it for 10 years.
So you did both the Gourmet magazine
and that.
GMA.
And so I did not just for her, but all the chefs on GMA. And that was wonderful. That's how I met everyone.
Yeah, that's interesting. And but it also entailed getting up really, really early.
Yeah, that was brutal. Oh, my God.
I've only done those morning shows like two or three times.
It's brutal.
It's like, I don't know how people do this every day.
No.
So then, though, the thing that young people who are into food don't know that much about is you did a live television show on the Food Network, starting in 1996.
Correct.
Every night.
First 5 nights a week for the first 9 months.
Right.
And then four nights a week after that for the rest of the time I was there.
And that's a totally crazy thing. First of all, people don't do live cooking shows except on Facebook or whatever it is, or a social platform. What was that like?
I loved it, Ed. If anybody ever asked me, what's your favorite thing you've ever done in the industry, it was that first show. I was on the Food Network for almost 10 years. I missed 10 years by 2 months. But that show was called Cooking Live, and it was really live. It wasn't live to tape. It wasn't a live audience. It was live, complete with dirty phone calls. I dropped it. I burned it. I didn't finish the recipe. You know, my guest fell off the riser. You know, it was wild. I think you were on it, too.
Yes. I think I was on it.
Yes.
It
was so much fun. And whatever happened. And every night, my friend described it as like a town hall. People would call in with their questions. We'd have a topic, and people would call in. And that's how I got a real sense of what home cooks were doing around the country. And I fell particularly in love with the South because I discovered they cook more, can more, bake more, dine more than anywhere else in the country. But the other thing that was fun about it was that people would sometimes help me. So we took about 5 calls a night, and let's say somebody asked me a question I didn't know the answer. Well, the next call, they might know the answer, because this was pre-Google.
Right.
So there was no way to go. You know,
right.
I'd go home every night, and you know, sometimes if I didn't know the answer, I'd say, I'd get back to you with the answer tomorrow. It's like, you know, of the old days of the soap operas. You know, tomorrow we'll you'll find out if Susie and Johnny really split up,
right,
or did they get back together again. Well, for me, it would be really, what is the difference between golden and black raisins?
Yeah.
Which is one of the burning issues. So, yeah, that was great. But not only did I do that, I also morphed from doing behind the scenes at GMA to being their on-air food correspondent, which I did from 6 to 8 times a year. So I did Gourmet and the Food Network at night, and then sometimes in the morning I would do GMA.
This was supposed to make life easier for you as a working mother?
No, it was ridiculous. Ridiculous. Yeah.
But you survived, and
I did it. Well, you know, you can do anything as long as you know there's an end in sight. Yeah, in 1999, I did 2 live shows, one from 7 to 8 and one from 10 to 11. We did that for 9 months because they wanted to see if the later model would work. So that was particularly hairy.
And you didn't really set out to be on TV.
Never. I thought that was vulgar. You know, being a good WASP, it's like, oh, then you're looking for attention. But, of course, there's Julia, who's fantastic, who did it. But I thought most people who are on TV just need a lot of attention. But how I got past it and decided that it would be a good idea, you know, Lou Eckes, who trained a lot of, he's a great media trainer. He and Lisa Eckes, they were still together back then, trained me to do TV when I was invited to be on the Food Network because I was terrible. And how he got me to feel comfortable in front of the camera was he helped me to figure out that the reason that I had a mission, and it was to teach. I love to teach. And once I decided, okay, I'm going to be helping people, then I didn't feel so self-conscious.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And it seemed like a good idea, which was your original question. I never wanted to be on TV. I always wanted to be a chef.
Right.
But then I believe that what I do best is actually teach.
Yeah. And that's what's interesting is that that is the consistent thread in your work.
Mm-hmm.
Alice Waters was talking to us about how important it was that there be a family meal on the table every night. Like, you are really doing that on live TV.
And by the way, we did have family dinner when I got home from
doing
the show.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask you. Like, how did you do that?
Well, it was a couple of weeks in, so I would go do this show. I'd have to be there at 5, and then I'd be done by 8, and then I'd get home by 8:15. So 2 weeks in, Bill and I always, you know, ate dinner together anyway. In some ways, the show got us eating family dinner sooner. But 2 weeks in, because I wasn't seeing the kids as much as I wanted to, I said to Ruthie, who was the older, she was 9, I was like, why don't you know, stay up and have dinner with me and Daddy, you know, have a snack. And then, you know, I got a serious babysitter, some really good people to help out. And so she did. Well, Sammy wasn't going to be left behind. He was 5. And so he started having dinner with us. And that was sort of a joke because Sammy wasn't ready for primetime, meaning dinner, but he didn't want to be left out. But you got to start somewhere. So we did. And so that's sort of when we really started doing it religiously. And even when I did that live show, I'd come home in between shows to have dinner. So we'd do 7 to 8 and 10 to 11, and I'd come home in between and we had dinner.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really impressive.
Yeah.
Sarah, we've covered so much ground, but we haven't even gotten to your current gigs. Hosting Sarah's Weeknight Meals, co-hosting Milk Street Radio, writing for the Washington Post and the Associated Press. So we're going to wrap up this week's episode of Special Sauce, and then you and I are going to continue yapping.
Okay.
For part 2 of This Is Your Life, Sarah Moulton.
Okay.
So long, serious eaters.